Hey, you want to support all the Upstairs Studio podcasts? It's as simple as this. Use our Amazon link when you shop Amazon. We get a small percentage of what you spend. You don't pay any extra. You get your stuff from Amazon. Everybody wins. Where do you find the link? Well, it's on the Explorations Early Learning app. You can find it on the Explorations Early Learning website. If you don't find it in those places, just get a hold of Jeff on Facebook or via email, and he'll hand deliver it to your inbox. Thanks for your support. Bye-bye.
Welcome to the Dirty Playologist. It took some doing, but we drugged Keisha and Barb into the studio to record. They're going to be digging deep and getting to the roots of play. Things like knowledge, skills, understanding, and power. Here are your hosts, Keisha and Barb.
Hello, 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 and welcome to Dirty Playologist. It's Keisha here with my lovely co-host,
Barbara Sheridan.
And today we have a special guest. We're both so excited. It is Peter Gray, the author of Free to Learn. Hi, Peter.
Hi.
So we're really excited to have you here today because we're going to talk about something that's near and dear to both of our hearts, and it's the idea that children teach themselves. They naturally teach themselves. So if you don't mind telling us a little bit about yourself and what you do and how that topic relates to you and your work.
Okay. Yeah, I'm a professor of psychology. Actually, I'm retired from teaching but continue to do research. So I have the title of research professor at Boston College. I'm an evolutionary psychologist, which means that I'm interested in human nature and how that nature came about by natural selection. And I'm especially interested in the nature of children, and most especially interested in those aspects of children's nature that lead them to become educated, which really are all those characteristics of childhood that we think of when we think of children. Their curiosity, their enormous curiosity. You can't stop them from exploring. Their playfulness, in which they play in so many different ways and practice kind of all the skills that one needs to develop to become a highly well-functioning human being. Their sociability, the fact that they want to connect with other people and learn what other people know and do what other people can do. Their willfulness, if you will, the fact that they want to run their own life, they want to do their own things, they want to figure out what it means to live in this world and to live it in their way while still abiding by the norms of the culture into which they're born. And then there's one other aspect of their of human nature that's children's nature too that plays a role in self-education, and that's planfulness. We are the species that thinks ahead, that thinks about tomorrow, and children don't start right off thinking very far ahead, but as they grow older, they begin to think more and more ahead and to make more and more conscious plans for how to prepare for tomorrow and for years ahead as they grow older.
Wonderful. And so this is something that you believe children do without school.
Yes.
Barbara and I both work in a early childhood setting. I'm with children from 1 year old up to 5 years old. And Barbara, what is your group? Ages?
We have one toddler group, which is walking to 3, and then our other ages go from 3 till 8.
Mm-hmm. And we're both in an environment where it is basically just what you said, children learning through play, children learning through living, children learning from each other. And that mixed age group setting, it's proof every day of what I read in your book, Free to Learn. And when I read it, it was such a refreshing book to read because it put a lot more of an evolutionary spin, that back knowledge of why this is working. Why?
I don't know why. Okay, yeah, and Yeah, no worries. We were just in the middle of chatting about adults and kind of how adults are kind of fitting into it. So I'll just go back to my question. So basically we were talking about the kids and what they're getting from adults. And so in our actual situations, because, you know, the parents are coming and dropping their kids off, so adults are actually present in the environment all the time. So what do you see as the adult's role? Because you talk a lot about, you know, the adults not doing the forced education, allowing, you know, the kids to follow their own interests. So what is the adult's actual role in the setting when they're there with the children to allow that self-directed education to happen?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, my first statement would be, you know, given today's world and the realities of how many people think about their role with children, my first inclination would be to say what the adults should not be doing.
Yes.
And that is that they should not be interfering with the children's play. They should not be trying to direct the children. They should not be trying to teach the children. Children need space and time, and you know, the most important lessons that they're learning are lessons that they're learning in play with their peers. And those lessons are things that can be spoiled by the presence of adults, by the too obvious, too proximate presence of adults. Lessons in how to initiate your own activities, how to solve your own problems, how to deal with other people, how to negotiate your play with other children, how to deal even with what to an adult might look like bullying, but is the kind of way that kids interact with one another, how to assert yourself and manage the social problems of life. This is what we are in our culture today too often depriving children of the opportunities to learn these things, because we're all too ready to intervene. We're too ready to step in and immediately pick the child up if he falls, or tell the child, no, don't do that, it's too dangerous, or, oh, you must stop squabbling here, you know, let me solve this problem for you. That's something that, the more we do that kind of thing, the more we're preventing children from learning how to manage these problems themselves. And, you know, I'm looking at not just children, but young adults and who are entering college. And, you know, there's a real crisis today. I'm not sure if everybody's aware of it, but certainly everybody in the higher academic world is aware of it. We have a crisis today on almost every college campus in the country due to the overwhelming demand for mental health facilities. Children, young people are growing up not prepared to manage their own lives by the time they go off to college. And everything becomes, for many of them, an emotional crisis. And there's been a lot written about this. For example, in the Chronicle of Higher Education had an article a while ago. And there have been a number of other publications that surveys of mental health centers in colleges and universities across the country, and they're all overwhelmed. There's a lot of discussion on campus about how to deal with this crisis, because it's affecting the classroom, it's affecting the academic pursuits in the university, because so many students are having mental health problems, often triggered by events that in the past one would have been able to solve oneself, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And of course many young people still can, but the proportion who can't has risen enormously. Things like roommate problems, or having a romantic breakup, or getting a bad grade, or these things become emotional crises because we've overprotected our children. We've protected them from failure. We've protected them from having to deal with these kinds of problems themselves. And I think that we need to begin, you know, even with little kids. Little kids are amazingly resilient, amazingly socially competent when we allow them to be so. But we can sort of take that away from them if we become overprotective. So, you know, I think the role of adults is first of all, not to be too present. You know, you certainly need somebody with little kids. You need somebody who's keeping an eye on them so that in case somebody does get seriously hurt or it seriously seems to be endangered. But that eye ought to be not too close. You don't want to be there as a person to be, you know, to tattle on somebody too. You don't want to be there as the first line of how to solve a problem whenever it arises. You kind of want to be there for when you really do have to be there, but not otherwise. I think that if the adults are there, they should talk with the other adults. They should be adults. They should do adult things. they don't need to play with the kids. Kids play with one another better than they play with adults. That's kind of my view on it. If the parents want to be there, that's fine. But if I were managing the facility, I would really have very clear instructions to the parents that they are not to intervene.
Mm-hmm. And that was something that I struggled with early on when I first opened the program, because I have such strong feelings about not intervening. And I had parents that would come into the facility, and the first thing that they wanted to do was intervene every chance they got. They wanted to teach things. They wanted to quiz and test. So I decided I was going to have a meeting. And in this meeting, we were going to discuss very clearly our philosophy, why we do and don't do things. And it took so long. I had this one dad, and he loves to be around the children, and he's wonderful in the classroom. We love his presence. But it took so long to get him to understand that he was not helping his daughter. He was not helping the children. It wasn't until one day that his daughter himself told him to stop.
Good for her.
She told him to stop, and she told him to leave. And it wasn't until that day that he came back and talked to me. And I think he got it. And then after that, he comes in, and he's there, and he's present, but he's more as an observer, more as a support and less as a distraction or leader of their play. So I do think it's really important that we figure out a way to include those parents who want to be included, but on the terms of what's best for the children, which is get out of their way.
I think that's a good point. And of course, to be in some sense sympathetic with the parents, I mean, that's out of completely good motives that they want to be helpful and they want to teach and so on and so forth. But it is right. And it's often necessary to explain to parents that this is that you're holding back and you're letting the children solve the problems, and you're not because of negligence. Otherwise, people will think you're just not doing your job. Right? I mean, but because they're. And to really articulate the reason for this, that, throughout history, children have played with other children largely away from adults, and they're biologically designed to learn in such play. And we have this problem today that we have deprived them of self-directed, self-initiated, self-chosen play away from adults. And it's the biggest thing that our kids need right now in this day and age. And so it really means, whether it's parents, whether it's teachers, whether it's camp directors, holding back rather than moving forward into their space.
It's something that my staff and I have really been reflecting upon, because the more we observe the children outside of our presence, we're always outside of what I call the bubble. But we were talking last week about stepping back even further and maybe not going in so quickly when there's a conflict. I feel like we're pretty held back on that. But I said, take a few more steps back, because I know from my own childhood and playing outside with friends, if you just think about it, we didn't have adults around. So you learn quickly who to pick on. You learn quickly who you can't mess with. You learn quickly, that way to play, the negotiation, the communication, and those things that I think that we're robbing children of when we're just too present, when we're in there. Even when we're scaffolding and supporting them, I think maybe we even step in too soon with that sometimes. So we've been actively taking even more of a step back from that, and what we see is amazing. We see children who are working things out. they're using the skills that we've modeled as adults just in our communication to each other in the space. So it reminds me of just what happened when I was a child. I didn't go to preschool, and I was just in a neighborhood with about 50 children of all different ages, and our parents would communicate and be doing their own thing, and we were privy to that, so we could see it modeled, but in our own play, we weren't disturbed, we weren't guided, we weren't led, but we always worked it out, we always figured it out, we always, I mean, honestly, there wasn't much conflict, but when it did arise, we didn't look to the adults to solve it. I don't ever remember running to get my mommy.
And according to anthropologists, you know, in the whole history of the world, in the whole history of the human species, this is the way children have always played, mm-hmm. away from adults. And this is how the child's nature is designed to play in those ways and to learn what are really the most important lessons of life. You know, the most important lessons of life are not reading and writing and arithmetic. You know, the most important lessons of life are how to initiate your own activities, how to solve your mm-hmm. own problems, how to get along with other people, how to negotiate differences, even with those people that are a little tough to get along with, you know? These are the things that determine whether we have a happy and productive and successful life. There are people who have a happy and successful life who don't know how to read. You can get along without knowing how to read, believe it or not. There are heads of businesses who don't know how to read, who have dyslexia, you know. But the other thing is everybody, unless they've got a very serious brain problem, is going to learn how to read anyway. So we worry about the wrong things. We mm-hmm. worry about whether they're reading on schedule, whether they're picking up numbers on schedule. And we don't worry enough about, are they learning to live their own lives? And that's the crucial thing. If somebody figures out how to live their own life, they will also then figure out what they need to learn, and they'll figure out how to learn it in their own way. All they need is the opportunity. They don't need to be forced.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually had a particular conversation with somebody that went exactly like that when they were talking about unschooling, because they were saying, well, you know, some kids, they just needed to be prodded to read because they're really not that interested. And I said to them, quite honestly, if my son never learns to read, but he can figure out how to navigate in this world and be a happy person and do something that makes him happy and has him being within whatever society he chooses, I'm happy. I don't care if he learns to read or not. Now, I think to get to that point, he's not going to be able to have to pick up reading at some point to get there. But if he can manage to do it and he's happy, then...
I think that's right. And the fact of the matter is he will learn to read, you know.
Exactly.
I mean, Sudbury Valley School, where I've done so much of my research, where they don't teach reading, you know. They don't teach any courses. The kids are there from age 4 on through typical high school age. They play and interact. They follow their pursuits. There has never been a student who reached certainly not beyond mid-teenage years, without learning to read. Most of them learn to read at sort of kind of typical ages for reading, somewhere between 4 and 7 or 8. But some don't learn to read until later. They don't seem to have, it's not because they can't, it's not because their brain isn't developed, I'm convinced of that. It's just that they didn't develop it, they had no particular interest in it, they had no strong reason to read. Mm-hmm. But at some point in this culture, if you're in this literate culture and everybody around you is reading and you can't help but see the value of reading, at some point, sooner or later, for different kids, you realize, hey, you know, it's really valuable to read. Or I really want to read this, and so now I better sit down and figure out how to read. And they learn to read very quickly when it's their own motivation. The difference between a child learning something that he or she really wants to learn and the child learning something because they are being more or less forced to learn it by, you know, rewards and punishments and curriculum that they're required to be going through, the difference is amazing. I mean, the child learning because he or she wants to looks brilliant compared to the child who's learning it because they're being required to do so.
Mm-hmm. Now, Keisha, we could probably chat for hours, I think.
I know.
But you'd wanted to talk a little bit about the Play Empowers Conference, too, didn't you?
Yeah, I just want to let everybody know that Mr. Peter Gray is going to be attending our Play Empower Pet Rally this year in June 8th through the 11th at Adamstown, Maryland. We're so excited to be able to talk to you a lot longer and learn a lot more from you, Peter. Everybody can find information about the conference at playempowers.blogspot.com. Where can they get in touch with you, Peter, and also find your writings?
Well, they can find my writings. I do a regular blog for Psychology Today magazine. The blog is called Freedom to Learn. So you can find that easily. Just Google Peter Gray, Freedom to Learn, or Peter Gray Psychology Today blog. So that's one way. I've got about 130 essays there on topics having to do with play and children's development and how children learn and a number of other more peripherally related topics. Also, if people are interested in my academic writing, if you go to the author page of my blog, I've put PDFs of some of my academic articles there. Of course, my book, Free to Learn, Why Releasing the Instinct to Play Will Make Our Children Happier, Healthier, and Better, Happier, more Self-Reliant, and Better Students for Life, is the place to get the most clear and full exposition of the research and ideas that I've been developing over the years. And I am on Facebook if people want to follow me on Facebook. I've reached the limit of members, so I'm sorry I can't.
Oh, wow. I didn't even know there was a limit of members. That's amazing.
So you can follow me, and every once in a while I'm able to take on another new friend, I guess, because I've realized somebody else is not not using their Facebook anymore, and I can remove them. So, but for the most part, I'm unfortunate. I get many friend requests every day, and I.
So do not unfriend Peter, because you can't come back from that.
but one can still come to that. So those are the most easy ways to be in touch with what I'm doing.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming and chatting with us. And I cannot wait to get to meet you and give you a big hug in June. I hope you're a huggy person, because I am.
I'm looking forward to that very much.
Okay, wonderful. You can find me, Keisha, at facebook.com/discoveryearlylearning. And Barbara, where can everybody find you?
If you'd like more information about me or my program, which is located in Barrie, that's Barrie, Ontario, Canada, you can check me out on Facebook at Barrie Forest Kindergarten. And from there, you can get links to our workshops and trainings to see that we do for teachers. You can also get links to our blog and hear my perspective on nature, kids, play, education, and especially where they all intersect.
All right. Thank you, Peter. And thank you, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
This has been the Dirty Playologist. Back next week with another episode. Thanks for listening.
You can have all the Explorations Early Learning Upstairs Studio podcast with our new app. Just search your app store, Apple, Android, Kindle. We don't care what you use. Search the app store for Explorations.